Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu speaks out on possible Israeli retaliation against Iran.
But I want to make it clear, we will make our own decisions, and the state of Israel will do everything necessary to defend itself.
Plus, Israel and the war in the Middle East are playing a prominent role in the American election.
He's more concerned, seemingly, with placating the anti-Semitism in his base than standing with our historic and vitally important ally.
And later, an update from Kyiv as a hospital in northern Ukraine is struck by a Russian attack. Today is Wednesday, April 17th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Starting off in the Middle East today, as tension continues to rise following Iran's massive air assault against Israel this past weekend, Israel said it will respond. Diplomats and world leaders are urging restraint in an effort to prevent the war from escalating. Representatives from Britain and Germany were in Israel on Wednesday, where Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that Israel cannot be swayed by international pressure and will protect its own interests.
I am coming now from meetings with the foreign ministers of Great Britain and Germany. Last night, I spoke to British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, and soon I will also speak to other leaders. I thank our friends for their support in the defense of Israel, and I say this, both support in words and support in actions. They also have all kinds of suggestions and advice. I appreciate it. But I want to make it clear, we will make our own decisions, and the state of Israel will do everything necessary to defend itself.
Meanwhile, Qatari Prime Minister and Foreign Minister Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani said on Wednesday that talks on a Gaza ceasefire and a release of hostages are at what he calls a delicate phase. Qatar's premier condemned what he described as the Israeli policy of collective punishment in its war against Hamas, Gaza's ruling Palestinian Islamist group. The ceasefire negotiations mediated by Qatar and Egypt are continuing as a humanitarian crisis devastates Palestinians in Gaza with severe shortages of food, medicine, and hospital care. And as ceasefire negotiations are ongoing in Doha, UN membership negotiations are underway in New York. On Wednesday, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, said she does not see a U.N. resolution recommending the Palestinian Authority become a full U.N. member, helping lead to a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
On the recognition issue, I think our position has been clear. President Biden has said categorically that we support a two-state solution for addressing the situation in the Middle East, where Palestinians will have a state of their own and Israel is secure in their state. And we are working on the ground to get to that place as quickly as possible. We do not see that doing a resolution in the Security Council will necessarily get us to a place where we can find a solution, a two-state solution moving forward.
Thomas Greenfield made the comments at a news conference in Seoul after being asked whether the United States was open to recognize the request by the Palestinian Authority to have full UN membership. The Palestinian Authority is expected to push the 15-member Security Council to vote as early as Thursday on a draft resolution recommending it become a full member of the UN, diplomats said. Security Council member Algeria circulated a draft text late on Tuesday. The war in the Middle East is affecting American electoral politics, too, as U.S. presidential candidates Joe Biden and Donald Trump are both supporting Israel while trying to differentiate themselves from each other. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns reports.
Iran's attack on Israel and America's role in the Middle East as issues in this U.S. presidential campaign are a contest over which candidate backs Israel most. As incumbent, President Joe Biden oversaw the U.S. response to the attack and reaffirmed U.S. support for Israel in a meeting with the Iraqi prime minister.
The United States is committed to Israel's security. We're committed to a ceasefire that will bring the hostages home and preventing conflict from spreading beyond what it already has. We're also committed to the security of our personnel and partners in the region, including Iraq.
Politically, Biden is facing competing calls to do more to help secure the release of hostages held by Hamas and to get tougher with Israel over its attacks in Gaza. His opponent, Donald Trump, says none of the violence in the Middle East would have happened if he were still president, without explaining how.
I want to say God bless the people of Israel. They're under attack right now. That's because we show great weakness. This would not happen. The weakness that we've shown is unbelievable, and it would not have happened if we were in office. You know that. They know that. Everybody knows that.
The Trump campaign is working to portray Biden as weak on Israel on Trump's social media platform and through Republican lawmakers, including House Speaker Mike Johnson.
Joe Biden has transformed into an anti-Israel president. There's really no other way to characterize it. He's more concerned seemingly with placating the anti-Semitism in his base than standing with our historic and vitally important ally.
In the Midwestern state of Michigan, voter Carol Plissner says Biden needs to keep up his support for Israel.
I think initially President Biden's response to the situation was helpful and it was supportive. I think as time has gone on, that's become more questionable. And I think that the United States needs to have a stance that's deeply protective of democracy across the world. And that means deeply respectful of Israel.
Biden's support for Israel in Gaza is reason to oppose him, says Michigan voter Mohammed Mawri.
He's a complicit in a catastrophe that's happening 1,000 miles away. People think that it's not hurting us, but it is. We're aiding it with our money.
Polling by Pew Research last month showed deep divides on the issue, with about 20% of U.S. voters saying Biden's striking the right balance, another 20% saying he's favoring Israel, and 16% saying he's favoring Palestinians. The largest group in that poll was not sure how well Biden's handling the issue. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
With all the talk this week about potential retaliation against Iran, sometimes it's easy to forget that the war Israel is actively fighting is against Hamas. What does it mean to destroy Hamas, which has been designated by the U.S. as a terrorist organization, but is also the de facto governing authority in Gaza? For some insight, I spoke with David Aliberti. He's a Navy Federal Executive Fellow with the International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Again, thanks for having me, Steve. I appreciate it. And again, you know, I just want to state up front that as a military member on active duty, my opinions are mine alone and don't represent the official positions of the U.S. Navy, the DOD, or the U.S. government. But, you know, Hamas obviously is a designated terrorist organization, right? Designated as a foreign terrorist organization by the United States. And so what we know is historically efforts to destroy a terrorist group are, you know, very, very difficult. We don't have to look much further than our own experiences in Afghanistan and Iraq to understand that, you know, we can fight a group like Al-Qaeda, or the Taliban, you know, for years, you know, and not succeed in destroying it.
So is Israel misguided in thinking they can defeat Hamas?
So I'm glad you asked the question the way that you did. I don't think Israel is misguided at all. I think that, you know, to your original question about, you know, what does it mean to destroy Hamas, you know, the way we titled the article, you know, largely, you know, that may be viewed as a political statement, but, you know, to destroy Hamas and to defeat Hamas are two different things. We talked about in the article, you know, what some of those things mean. And, you know, in one fashion, it may, you know, that is one manner of destroying the group is by eliminating top leadership. And certainly that has been an objective that Israel has pursued. To defeat Hamas, rather, is, you know, perhaps a different objective, and you know, you see that that is clearly encompassed in what Israel is trying to do. They are absolutely trying to defeat Hamas. The overarching goal is to stop, you know, Hamas from ever having the capability to conduct an attack like they did on October 7th, 2023.
Well, if Hamas is a terrorist organization like ISIS, like Al-Qaeda, as you mentioned, a large part of that is ideological. How can you defeat an ideology without a countering ideology and a reality to that? There are some who are saying the way to defeat Hamas is to make life better for the Gazans, to make life good in the Gaza Strip so that people won't want to fight back.
Sure. And again, you know, we talked about three broad, you know, approaches for Israel to be able to defeat Hamas. Even though, again, you know, Israel's stated objective is to destroy Hamas. You know, one of those is to eliminate Hamas leadership. The second one, you know, is to destroy Hamas's hold on power by making alternative groups stronger. And we talked a little bit about, you know, what some of those alternative groups might be. But, you know, that's also a very difficult challenge. And there has to be a group that, you know, could potentially replace Hamas, which we did not identify that there was such a group either within, you know, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, or, you know, or the broader Middle East. The third thing is about countering the ideology, and you're absolutely correct. You know, the one of the ways in which you combat a terrorist ideology is by some sort of a counter narrative. This is an extraordinarily difficult thing to counter a terrorist ideology. And again, what we've seen as we have combated other terrorist groups in other parts of the world, you know, defeating a group, as in, you know, territorial defeat of ISIS, does not, in fact, destroy the group or destroy its ideology.
So you've researched the situation, you've researched the area, you're familiar with the actors and the players. If Israel succeeds in destroying Hamas by eliminating its leadership, by taking away its ability to do harm, what happens next? Who fills that void?
That's a great question, Steve, and that's always a concern. One of the things that we sort of touched on in the article from December was, you know, who winds up filling the leadership role to govern the Gaza Strip, because, you know, it's easy to identify a number of actors who aren't particularly interested in doing that. You know, Israel doesn't want to govern the Gaza Strip by and large. Neither do, you know, neighboring countries and some of the alternatives that, you know, that we mentioned, like the Palestinian Authority, who governs the West Bank, is both, you know, politically weak and largely corrupt. And so, you know, they're not an ideal choice. And again, for them to be a viable alternative, they have to, you know, the population of the Gaza Strip, the Palestinians would have to be receptive to that group as an alternative. I mean, there's not much indication that you know, there's a positive view of the Palestinian Authority in the Gaza Strip.
And we'll leave it there for today. David Aliberti is a Navy Federal Executive Fellow with the International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Mr. Aliberti, thanks for your analysis today. I appreciate your time.
Steve, thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. An update from Kyiv in just a minute, but first, a look into Russia. Moscow has avoided condemning Iran's attack against Israel, while at the same time calling on Israeli leaders to exercise restraint. Analysts say the Kremlin statement suggests it has chosen Iran as a preferred partner and abandoned the delicate diplomatic balance that it cultivated for decades in the region. Ricardo Marquina has this report narrated for us today by Steve Barragona.
The Kremlin reacted to the Iranian attack on Israel with a mix of diplomacy and retribution. Vladimir Putin's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, issued a statement by phone as reported by the Reuters news agency.
We're extremely concerned about the escalation of tensions in the region. We call on all countries in the region to exercise restraint.
From Russian representative to the United Nations, Vasily Nebenzia, a stronger statement that puts responsibility for any further rise in tension on Israel and the West.
We note the signal sent by Tehran that they do not seek a further military escalation against Israel. Israel, and we urge the West and Jerusalem to follow suit and reject the practice of provocative use of force in the Middle East.
In a post on social media, Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova criticized any expectation that Russia would condemn Iran for this attack, while Israel, she said, has not criticized Ukrainian attacks on Russian territory. Israel has condemned Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Analysts say the war in Ukraine has led Moscow to abandon what they describe as its previously moderate position in the Middle East, opting now to show clear support for Tehran.
The truth is that Moscow's very carefully controlled and calibrated relations with all of the Middle East powers is now a thing of the past. And the reason it has changed is because of the context of the war in Ukraine, whereby Russia wants what it wants, needs what it needs, and is willing to sacrifice some previous relationships in order to attain this.
As observers see it, Russia appears to have taken sides in the Middle East confrontation, signaling the growing impact of its full-scale invasion of Ukraine. For Ricardo Marquina, Steve Barragona, VOA News.
Early on Wednesday, Russian missiles struck the Ukrainian city of Chernihiv, only 150 kilometers from Kyiv. Several civilian buildings, including a hospital, were damaged. Meanwhile, President Volodymyr Zelensky announced Ukraine would request a meeting of the Ukraine-NATO Council devoted to the issue of protecting Ukrainian skies. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
Russian forces launched a missile attack on the city of Chernihiv early on Wednesday morning. As a result of the attack, civil infrastructure, an educational institution, a hospital, and 16 residential buildings were damaged. A rescue operation is underway. At least 17 civilians were killed and over 60 injured, including 3 children. 6 people are reported missing. The information is constantly updated. President Zelensky expressed his condolences to the relatives and friends of the victims. He emphasized that this tragedy could have been avoided if Ukraine had received sufficient air defense equipment and more help from allies.
We work every day without a single break to increase our potential in the world, in our relations with partners. We work to get more real help, to achieve true equality in the defense against terror. When the same truly equal rules apply to us here in Ukraine, in Europe, and in other parts of the world, when we face the same manifestations of terror, the same missile and drone attacks.
Meanwhile, President Zelensky, in his latest evening address, announced that Ukraine would make a request for a meeting of the Ukraine-NATO Council devoted to the issue of protecting Ukrainian skies, as he again recalled how the United States and other Western allies joined in repelling Iran's missile and drone attack on Israel.
Ukraine will request a meeting of the Ukraine-NATO Council to discuss the protection of the skies, the supply of anti-aircraft warfare, relevant systems, and missiles.
The White House has said that the U.S. will not participate in the war in Ukraine, and it will not shoot down drones launched by Russia, as it and its allies did last weekend in Israel. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
And some late-breaking news from the VOA newsroom. The U.S. House of Representatives will be voting on funding bills, including the funding bills for Ukraine and Israel, this coming Saturday evening. This after Speaker Mike Johnson, bowing to right-wing pressure from within his own party, had refused to put the Senate's larger, combined single funding bill up for a vote in the House. He split the Senate's bill into 4 smaller ones. For more, visit voanews.com. A sobering report now from the UN Population Fund. It says that African women are 130 times more likely to die of pregnancy or childbirth complications than women in Europe or North America. The AP's Julie Walker has the story.
UNFPA Executive Director Dr. Natalia Canham decries what she calls the widening inequality in sexual and reproductive health and rights worldwide.
The world made zero progress in saving women from preventable deaths in pregnancy and childbirth.
UNFPA's State of the World Population Report also estimates that nearly 500 maternal deaths per day occur in countries with humanitarian crises and conflicts, and shows that women of African descent in the Americas are more likely to die giving birth than white women. I'm Julie Walker.
And finally today, 1 year after Sudan's civil war started, international donors have pledged more than $2.1 billion in funding at a conference in Paris. Meanwhile, the UN says the looming famine in Sudan's capital, Khartoum, is unprecedented, and human rights activists are calling for justice. Henry Wilkins reports.
On Monday, 1 year from the start of Sudan's civil war, French President Emmanuel Macron announced at a Paris conference that international donors are pledging over $2.13 billion in aid to the country. Although details of when the money will be available are still scarce, the announcement will bring hope to aid workers who previously said only 6% of the funding needed for Sudan this year has been donated. Parts of the capital, Khartoum, have been flagged with a famine warning in recent weeks. VOA asked a top aid worker in Sudan whether he knows of any previous instances of a capital city anywhere in the world falling into famine. Justin Brady is head of the Sudan office for the UN's Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs.
In my experience, I've not heard of it. I spent 7 years in Somalia, and Mogadishu was actually where people went to find relief. Certainly, I think for most people, Somalia is, you know, sort of a synonym for a very difficult place to work. I'm finding this to be the most challenging environment operationally that I've ever seen. And as you mentioned, it's getting worse.
Aside from the lack of funding, aid workers say they are confronting security issues and a lack of access due to Sudanese bureaucracy. Most large humanitarian organizations pulled out of Darfur last year because of a lack of security. How the new funding will reach where it is needed most is unclear. Adam Rojal is an advocate for refugees and the displaced in Darfur, an area of Sudan that has also received famine warnings. He spoke to VOA via a video call from Darfur. He says his organization is seeing hunger and malnutrition in the displacement camps, and children are dying daily. He says that Doctors Without Borders has conducted a survey in the Zamzam displacement camp that proves it. A child dies there every 2 hours. Rojal also noted that since the start of the war, the paramilitary rapid support forces, or RSF, and Arab militias in Darfur have been perpetrating human rights abuses and ethnically motivated killings against black Sudanese. He says such full-fledged crimes need international intervention and punishment of the individuals who have committed them. He adds that justice is needed sooner or later, and that criminals need to be punished locally and internationally, and that no one should escape justice. Human Rights Watch says these killings are coordinated. Mohamed Osman is a researcher with the organization.
I think one of the main findings that we have been finding over and over is how these attacks were deliberate, how they were systemic. The strong mobilization and coordination between the RSF and the allied militias acting jointly.
8.2 million people have been displaced in Sudan, and 24.8 million, more than half the population, need humanitarian assistance, according to the UN. Henry Wilkins, VOA News.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.